Welcome to JBJS OrthoCore. Listen as members of the ortho community, residents, surgeons, educators, staff, and patients share their stories about the experiences and people most important in their lives and the lessons they learned along the way. OrthoCore is an audio archive inspired by StoryCore and independently organized by the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery.
So we're going to try and jumpstart the new technology that Mark Swinkowski told us about last week on the OrthoCore. This is a new online audio that is archived, that's organized by JBJS, that preserves the voices and the memories of the global orthopedic community. So this is a new way of capturing data, of capturing experiences, of capturing all kinds of ways of communicating with the published media. And today I'm going to try and accomplish two things. First, I want Bob to tell us a little bit about the history of the BU Orthopedic Program. And it's a program that's near and dear to my heart, of course, but Bob was there first and could give us a lot of the history. And that was what Mark Swinkowski wanted. And then I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about Bob's career. He's a longtime academic orthopedic surgeon who's had an amazing career, not only in academics, but in the athletic development of college and professional sports, and the role that medicine played in helping patients get through their injuries. So why don't we get started? Bob, can you talk to us? Can you tell us about the history of the BU Orthopedic Program? Tell us about Program 66 and how it developed at Lahey Clinic and then moved over to the Boston University campus.
Yes, Tom, the board started in 1934, and some of the places in Boston and around started having fellowships. And specifically, Boston City Hospital had a one-year fellowship, and the Shriners Hospital, which is, of course, in Springfield, did. Took a couple years, and then Lahey decided to have a fellowship. None of these were tied together, and in fact, they had people going here, there, and everywhere, but it was not a regular program until 1950. So it's some years for them to get going. At that time, the best known of the people in these various programs was a man called Ned Haggart, and he became the one that was the head of Program 66, which at that time, Boston City, Lahey Clinic, and the Shriners. And one of the things at that time—
Let me interrupt you for 1 second. Where does the name Program 66 come from? Were there 65 other programs and this is the 66th? Or is there some other reason?
It was assigned by the board, and that was given their official captions. This becomes Program 66.
Right.
And I put that up, and that I guess that's the way it came. So they were sort of midstream, if you would, informing things. Once they got going, it never really became a program in the sense that you and I think with everything got together. It was run by the Lahey Clinic primarily because they had people that were clerks and so forth that they could get to do it. And Dr. Haggart became the chief. As far as I can see, for 10, 11 years, the only time that they got together was when they selected residents. And they did that once a year, and then they selected residents. And apparently Dr. Haggard would then assign them. Everybody went 1 year here, 1 year here, 1 year here. And it was not really a program in the sense that we think it. Sometime in the early 60s, as Dr. Haggard was getting older, Dr. Hammond, who had come from a clinic in Pennsylvania and come from Michigan, he took over, and at that point, then they began to have a program that people recognized that you went here, there, and you were taken care of by Lahey. And at that time, they added a children's hospital in Lakeville called the Massachusetts Children's Hospital. It was not very good. It was chronic diseases, and there was a huge difference if you were sent to the Shriners or you were sent to Canton, which is where that hospital went. Was and also in Lakeville. So that's how the program was when I came in 64, and it remained that way. And I became chief in 67 because they had a time for people to retire as chiefs. And then in 1969, they had the first inspection of the program was after when I came. Dr. Al Ferguson from Pittsburgh, whom you would well know, who originally came from Boston, and in fact, his father had been an orthopedic surgeon in the Boston area. Anyway, Dr. Ferguson came, he visited Shriners, he visited City, he visited us, and at the end of this 2 days, Ferguson and I met. He was a very impressive person, Tom. It was amazing how he had one of his residents once said, Ferguson always looked like God should look. And it was kind of a very interesting time for me. We talked about the program, and then he said, Dr. Leach, he said, here's the situation. This program is not going to be able to go on as it is. I thought I was going to die. I mean, you know, take over the program and 2 years later, it's gone. And he said, you're going to have to affiliate with either the Tufts or Boston University, and then it will be the program and affiliated with that, and it will become that program. He said, now I know that you have been approached by both Tufts and BU about going there. And I said, how do you know that? He laughed. He said, believe me, I know. We find out things. He said, now, if I were you, what I would do is I would go to one of those places. He said, probably BU, because they don't have anything down there and you could start new. And I would go down there, and we will, once you're there, we will transfer the program from Leahy and so forth to BU, and it will become the Boston University Program 66. I was listening to him, Tom, and I was kind of trying to take all this in, and finally I said, can you do that? He said, I'm probably bored. Yes, I can do that. So I went home, told my wife. I was scared because it was so different from anything I had thought of. And shortly thereafter, the chief at Iowa came to Boston. I knew him because of friends and got talking with him. And the chief at Iowa, that's a long way from Boston, said to me, he said, Dr. Leach, you've had a couple of chances to leave Leahy. Do you not have a feeling you'd like to go to a university and build a bigger program? And I was just stunned. And I said, well, the other thing when you're young and you don't really know. So all of a sudden, within the course of about 20 days, two people who were very well known were saying, get out, get down there and start. So I went home, talked it over, went to BU where they had approached me. I knew the chief of surgery, and I had told him, why would I come here? You don't even have a program. So I went to him again, and I said, well, I got a new deal. We go down there, I can have a program, and it'll be that. So that's how it started, and I arrived July 1st, 1971, and Charles Gregory inspected the program on July 6th. On July 7th, I got a letter or a phone call from Dr. Ferguson saying, you have program 66. It's the Boston University Hospital program. And it was all them. I mean, I followed through, but I had no real idea of how things were done. And it's kind of an interesting thing when you realize particularly in that day, the power that they had. But they were trying to grow it. And Dr. Ferguson afterwards said, hey, several of us knew who you were, thought you had a lot of energy. We thought we could pull you there and get something out of the program.
So at this point in time, where was the Leahy Clinic physically?
The Leahy Clinic was still in Boston at that time. And when I had been recruited, I had been recruited as a hand surgeon. I'd had a whole week of fellowship when I was in the Navy and with Bunnell up in L.A. And
right.
I came as a hand surgeon, and I was told that I would be able to have a lab because I was doing some lab work at that time from the University of Minnesota, and that they would be out of Boston within 3 years.
Right. That
did not happen. And when I left, I was on the Board of Governors, and every month or so we left, I would say, are we any closer to moving? And the older guys would look at me like, you're really a dope. And so they didn't move, I think, until, I'm not quite sure, I think something like the beginning of the 80s, 70s.
One point of clarification. I know it was until 1997 when I came that Boston City Hospital and Boston University really made it official and really merged the programs and the teaching components and made it one institution.
When I went down,
right,
Tufts, Harvard, and BU all were there. But in 1974, the mayor of Boston said, there's no reason to bring three medical schools here. I want the deans to tell me the program and say who should be here. The dean at Harvard said, well, Harvard, it should come there. The dean at Tufts said, it's always worked. The dean at BU was a young man, and he put out a program. And so in the middle of 1974, Tufts and Harvard left. So I was at that time the chief at Boston City and the chief at University Hospital and the head of the program. So at that time it was, and for roughly 8 months or so, I probably did more of my work at Boston City than I did at University Hospital. And then I got David Siegel to come, which was one of the great moments of the program for us. But it was, what they didn't do was, it was not the same thing in terms of finances and running the whole hospital. The programs were BU.
So David Siegel came when?
I was trying to think. I think David probably came 1976, 77. He had been a resident. He was superb, went back to Israel, was disturbed because he found out that basically the way to advance is when someone died and then you moved up. So he called up one day and he said, do you think you'd have a job for me? And I said, oh my goodness, do I? And David came, and you know David, and what he did was absolutely remarkable.
Well, that's great. Bob, the other thing that's impressive about all this is your memory is perfect.
Well, I don't know whether it's perfect, but I'm told by my wife and friends that I'm a real pain in the neck because I remember things.
Oh, good. We appreciate it. Let me transition now and talk a little bit about you and your career. The things that I see just from my own getting to know you over the course of nearly 20 years. Well, it's been more than 20 years now. You were president of the AOA, editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Sports Medicine, chairman of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at Boston University. We just went over that. Team doctor to the Celtics and team physician for the U.S. Olympic team. Did I leave anything out?
Yeah, editor of the American Journal of Sports Medicine.
Yeah, I said that.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's, on the board. I was on the board, too, for 10 years. And I was the treasurer of the American Board of Orthopedic Surgery. I had a lot of energy. I had a lot of luck. I had a inability to say no because everything seemed interesting. And I think, like you, I know you had that problem, too, because you did a lot of things and were all over. And I enjoyed a lot of that. And I said to you once that I sent you a letter or an email, I said I was the prince of serendipity. It just seemed that I was standing in the right place at the right time when something would come up and someone would say, well, maybe Leach would do this or would you like to do this? And the majority of times it seemed interesting. And I think that's what sort of controlled my career to a large extent, that things came up and I thought, gee, that's interesting.
Right. I know we discussed by email yesterday the question that I always ask when I'm talking to someone about the career, and that is what they would have done differently if they had to do over again. You seem to think that you'd probably do the same thing. Maybe you'd change a few things, but nothing big. What is your feeling about that?
I think by and large, obviously, there are small things, mistakes you made. I mean, gosh knows I made plenty of mistakes. But I think if you look at the major things and the things I did, that I would do that. I think perhaps there were a couple of times, I mean, in the 1990s, I had a lot of things on my plate. And I think that it would have been that once there were one or two things that I might have said no, but in a way they were interesting and I was sort of afraid to lose it. So I think by and large, I would do it. The biggest worry in all this, and you would be aware, is that with all of this that's on your plate and what you're doing, your family or your practice somehow can be hurt. In my instance, I know that my practice went down, which I was okay with. Things were good with the family because of my wife. But I will say that there are times when I was sort of juggling balls and I kept thinking, gee, will I catch the last one before it hits the floor?
I know the feeling.
Yeah, I know you do.
Bob, is there anything that we can, that's going on at the journal that you've seen? As the editor of the American Journal of Sports Medicine, you probably spend more than a little bit of time looking at what the other journals are doing. From your perspective, is there anything that you see at JBJS that you would work on as a project or try and change if you had the druthers?
I think the problem now is I've been out of the game for a long time, Tom. The thing that the journal, of all the things I did, in a way, I think the journal was the biggest, not problem, but the biggest project, because it had been down in Columbus, Georgia. It had been run sort of in the shop by Jack Houston, who was wonderful, but he was a totally different person. I wanted to take the journal myself from cases and people I have done, and all of whom did well, to a really scientific journal. And of course, at that point, the JBJS is the thing that you're aiming at. And so when I took over, I wanted to attract people of more scientific papers. I had to get better reviewers. And that was probably the major thing that I did in the first 2 years. I recruited people to be the reviewers, and the reviewers determine a lot how the papers are published and so forth.
Right.
They did a good job because so many of them are still with the journal. So then, having done that, the thing was to try to convince people. Frank Norris, for instance, was doing a lot. He was in sports medicine, but he was publishing the JBJS. Convince Frank Norris and others to do that. So one of the things that I thought was that we really have to get out there, wave the flag, and show people why you want to have it done. Get enough papers so that then you can be selected. It's like, you know, choosing students for Harvard. Harvard gets good students. Well, they should. Good Lord, they get thousands of people applying. Well, if you're getting lots of papers. So I think the basic thing at that time for me was getting better papers, better reviewers, and making sure that good papers were published and that people knew we were out there. As far as looking at other journals now, the only thing I do know is that with Bruce Ryder having followed me, and by the way, having done a better job than I did, that the quality of the papers is superb, and it's branched out because, you know, it used to be, what do you know about the anti-accrue shit, then gradually going out. And now, if you look in there, he's writing things about all the biologic solutions, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think that when you're running a journal, the thing that you've really got to do is make sure that you're not keeping up, but that you've got a step and a half ahead, knowing who the young people are, knowing what they're doing, and trying to convince them that this is a good thing to get into. And finally, making sure that whatever you publish is good and has been vetted and so forth. And I think that I started that for the journal. I think Bruce has carried it well beyond what I did. I haven't been with the JBJS for a long time, but I do know that when they were looking for the new editor and I went over to talk with them, I know Harry Cowell, who became the person that took it, I looked at the journal and I thought, wow, for a journal that's way ahead, the journal looks sort of pedestrian then. And I think it's changed, like other things have, a great deal since then.
Right. You know, it's interesting hearing you say this, because when Mark Swinkowski took over as editor-in-chief of JBJS, I had a discussion with him, and one of the first things that he noticed is that as editor-in-chief, he's got to learn the entire field of publication, that it's not just a matter of running it the way Harry Kahl did, which was making sure that the lines were edited appropriately, but taking on a new job with a new challenge to keep up to date with how the technology is moving. And he's done an outstanding job with that. And one of it is as evidenced by things like OrthoCorp, which provide a new way of communicating among us. I think that's been great. I think I've covered the things that I wanted to do, and we talked for an hour, almost 20 minutes. So I think we are just about at the end. Bob, I have one last question. What drew you to rock climbing?
I'm a jock, as you know, and they at school at Princeton, they said I was a gentleman jock because I knew how to tie a tie and I could read and write. I've been a jock all my life. I've enjoyed it. And I got into rock climbing because of my daughter out in Colorado. She was a very good rock climber. And I went out once alone without my wife, and she was worried what to do with me. She decided that she'd put me in rock climbing. You know, most things I got into, I got really interested, and rock climbing was that. And I was very lucky. I met a younger guy who ran a big school up in Acadia. We became very close friends within about 2 or 3 days. I've done things that he hasn't. He's done things I haven't. And I climbed, and I'm 91 now. My last climb, I was 89, about 12 days before I was going to be 90. But we went climbing, and that day I thought, you know, this is a good time to hang it up. And so I'm not climbing anymore, but I loved it. It's a challenge, you know. It's you guys like you and I, we meet challenges. I don't care whether it's academic or physical or emotional or what have you. We meet challenges, and that was the challenge for me, and it was very nice for me.
So that leads me to what would have to be the last question, but I think you've helped me figure out what that question would be, and that is, what is your next challenge?
I guess staying around, Tom. It is interesting, though. COVID changed things for everybody. And we used to travel a lot, and we have a couple of good friends that we've traveled with, and we haven't done that. And then in 8 days, I'm taking the first overseas trip that I've taken in 3 years. We're going around Ireland. So I guess the next thing is keep reading, keep looking forward to it. And, I guess don't sort of fade away. I think I want to go out fighting.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Bob. Thank you for that. Thank you for the outstanding job that you did. Thank you for laying the groundwork for me when I came and succeeded you. And thanks for your time today.
And thanks for taking the BU program on to steps that they weren't going to take with me. And I will say that things went up, and that's kind of nice. It's good when you've done something and someone takes it over and it goes up. Same thing happened with the journal. So twice I had something that went forward. Kind of lucky for me.
Well, you make your good luck, that's for sure.
Right. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Bob.